From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Steve Goldstein for MarketWatch and Tracy Wilkinson for Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is Washington journalist Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. President Donald Trump delivered his annual State of the Union address, a speech that contained calls for unity, but stood firm in Trump's key policy issues, especially the construction of a wall on the U.S. southern border. The newly elected Democratic majority in the House of Representatives began exerting its influence, announcing the launch of sweeping probes into the campaign and personal finances of President Trump. Russia announced that it would follow the United States and withdraw from the INF Weapons Treaty, triggering fears of a new arms race between the two nuclear superpowers. And a new report by the United Nations that was shown to the Security Council claims North Korea is working to ensure its weapons cannot be destroyed by military strikes. The report comes as the U.S. announced upcoming meetings with North Korea on eliminating its nuclear arsenal. Tracy, Steve, welcome. Let's start with the State of the Union, which finally happened, delayed by the previous shutdown, maybe bordered by another shutdown, but we'll get to that later on in the conversation. About a 90-minute speech that was in some ways surprising to me and in some ways quite predictable. I'll start with you, Tracy. The president said that he wanted to give a speech that would promote unity. Do you think he did that?
No. I think he started out that way. He certainly, as you say, the White House had previewed this speech as being about unity. He started out that way, talking about bipartisan legislation, where can we all get together. But pretty quickly, he shifted to more of what people call a campaign speech, where he hit on the same issues that have been so divisive all along. The border wall, which the Democrats say they do not want, a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico, abortion, the threat of socialism. You know, I didn't know we were in danger of becoming a socialist country, but he vowed to keep us from being that. So it seemed to fairly quickly pivot to more of a campaign speech in which he as I say, hit on really divisive issues that we can expect to see him drill down on in the next year and a half.
I agree with you. The policy points were very much in line with what he has spoken to right down the line, and sometimes in very heated terms on Twitter and in his sort of campaign-style rallies that he does from time to time. Steve, your take on this speech. Do you think it was overall an effective State of the Union address?
Well, I think it was one of the more coherent agendas that he's laid out as president. And I do wonder if he came to Washington with this State of the Union as his inaugural. I think it could have helped set a better blueprint, really, for what he was trying to accomplish.
And that's a very good point. When you juxtapose the two, this was a much lighter speech, much lighter address than the inaugural.
And, you know, if you think back to the inaugural, I think maybe you would remember American Carnage, this yep. very bleak view of the American landscape. And this one was much more optimistic, talking about space, honoring D-Day legends. And I don't really think, to what Tracy was saying, it's particularly consistent with how President Trump governs. And it very much was a campaign. This was very much 2020. But if you look at it just in and of itself, you would get a sense, if this was his blueprint, it'd be one where he would work with the Republicans on issues of both business as well as security, where if you believe the State of the Union, he'd work with the Democrats on social issues like drug care pricing, which he's talking about, and where he would pursue both his protectionist trade policy, which he set out in very clear terms, as well as his more isolationist foreign policy. So it did. There was coherence to it. I think this is what his RNC speech will probably be like in another year or so when he accepts the nomination in all likelihood. But I also agree that it doesn't really speak to how the White House actually operates.
Yeah, I mean, in the State of the Union, again, the president sort of gives a State of the Union on an hourly basis, you know, via his Twitter account. So I think it sort of diminishes the magnitude of the speech overall. Let's talk a minute about the Democratic response given by Stacey Abrams, who was a candidate for governor in Georgia, did not win. She's not currently an elected official, but is highly regarded as a rising star in the Democratic Party. And she gave the Democratic response. What did you think of the response? Do you think it was effective, and did it accurately juxtapose the message from the Trump State of the Union?
Yes and no. I think she had her own issues to talk about, which, you know, is fine. It is unusual, as you point out, that someone who's not an elected official give the response. Mm. She, I think, emphasized what had been part of her campaign as for governor was the right to vote and the access to vote, which is still an issue that Democrats find very important, not something that Trump talked about at all, yet something that the Republicans are resisting in terms of any new legislation that would make it easier to vote. So she, you know, on the one hand, yes, did respond to some of what he brought up, but also had her own issues to put forward, which are, you know, strong Democratic issues.
Yeah. Yeah, she was definitely talking about her personal story. I think it's a big part of what she had her personal rise.
And it's worth noting that Trump did give a shout out to the number of women who are in Congress now. Which
that was a light
moment.
It was a nice moment there.
Yeah, with Nancy Pelosi, of course, sitting behind him for a change. So that was all very interesting as well.
And that's a good pivot point to where I want to go next, Steve. I'll go to you. We had Nancy Pelosi sort of framing and bordering the president in the background for every single minute of the speech. Traditionally, the State of the Union is followed by a budget from the White House. And it looks as though now the State of the Union is much more likely to be followed by a call for a shutdown or a declaration of a state of emergency from the White House. Was there anything in the State of the Union that gives you hope that a compromise will be reached that will avoid a shutdown?
Not in the State of the Union, per se. The issue of whether the government will close again, I still think it is very much an open question. I think there is a chance that it won't shut down. And I do find it interesting that both Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, they're giving them some space to negotiate. I still think there's a possibility that they could reach an accord and then really put it to the president as to whether he wants to sign it into law or not. And as I think at this point, it's still unresolved. I don't think the president wanted to concede any ground during the State of the Union, and he definitely did not. That doesn't mean that it's a no-go, that we're definitely closing on February 15th. I still think there's a possibility of some sort of deal. It could be also this idea of an emergency declaration, which
no one seems to be in favor of, even within the president's own party.
Well, the Republicans in particular don't want it, because you can imagine a Democratic president wanting to, you know, for all sorts of spending initiatives. I do think if there is that sort of declaration, it would immediately or very quickly get to the courts. It would be blocked. And in some respects, that could actually be a win-win for everybody, right? That President Trump gets to say he went all out to try to build the wall. And not only was he not helped by Congress, the courts that he's previously railed against have blocked him, too. That way, also, the U.S. government keeps running. 800,000 federal workers keep getting a paycheck. Could be a win-win-win, really, for everybody to declare this emergency declaration, have the courts basically say, no, we're not going to do any of it, and then have Washington maybe move on.
That's quite the strategy you've worked up there. the White House is listening to that. Let's move on to the House of Representatives. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff has opened broad investigations of President Trump, including the inaugural committee, personal finances, and I think most interesting to certainly myself, the president's income taxes. Start with you, and Steve, stay with you. What in particular do you think these investigations are looking for?
They're looking for everything.
Yeah.
And I also think, though, that there's almost this backlog of outstanding issues because the Republicans investigated very little of it. They did, in both the House and Senate, proceed with a look at the Russian finances, tiptoed around, but they did start that. On none of these other issues, from conflicts of interest to Trump's taxes, anything like that, they did absolutely nothing for 2 years. And now there are many in the House on the Democratic side who are very keen to do it. So I think there's kind of this backlog. It'll be interesting to see what of the different strands really has the most momentum. I do think the income tax issue will be fascinating, but as will some of these other ones. And you do the issue into his inaugural committee, which you also have, it appears, a criminal investigation into. Perhaps, you know, that kind of thing could end up being the issue that generates the most trouble from the White House. It looks like on taxes, they're going to try to delay using every kind of tactic that they can. So I don't know that we will ever see Trump's taxes.
Tracy, these investigations are apart from the Mueller investigations. How do these investigations differ from the Mueller investigations? And should the White House be even more worried about these in some sense than the Mueller investigation? Because I've heard that opinion stated.
Yeah, possibly. It's hard to know what Trump is thinking exactly. But from all the reporting that we've done and others, he's very worried about these investigations that can be so much more specific. And they end up being much more public. You know, the thing about the Mueller investigation is he is tight-lipped. And we get little hints here and there when there's a filing in court. But the House investigations can be much more public and air a lot more dirty linen. I'm not so sure about the tax returns, given that it was always a traditional component of any campaign for the candidates to release their tax returns. It's hard to see how far Trump's people can resist. But, you know, again, legally, they probably do have a leg to stand on. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But yes, I think the president probably is a lot more concerned. And he knows that the Democrats are out for a certain certain pound of flesh. So I think that he is probably quite worried about them.
And when you say that they're out for a pound of flesh, he acknowledges, we use the word like witch hunt and that sort of thing. We use that right down the line. And he's talked about this being an extension of the witch hunt. The other term that is getting lots of play from the president in person and on Twitter is presidential harassment.
Right.
Is this, in fact, presidential harassment, or do you think It's oversight.
Now, will it be particularly enthusiastic oversight? Perhaps. But yes, even in his State of the Union, he referred to the harassment, and he even suggested there can't be peace and prosperity if he's under investigation, which is an interesting connection. So yes, he's seeing this as harassment, but I think normally this would be seen as oversight if, you know, indeed an enthusiastic, aggressive oversight. But yes, oversight.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more issues in the news.
Issues in the News is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. Did you know you can download our program? It's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, go ahead and check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now, back to our panel, Steve Goldstein for MarketWatch and Tracy Wilkinson for Los Angeles Times. Our moderator is Washington journalist Michael Williams.
Welcome back. Following the U.S. lead, Russia announced it was withdrawing from the INF treaty, also announcing that it was beginning development of new medium-range missile systems. This, to me, was completely predictable, in a word. Steve, we'll start with a quick description of the INF, what it means, and what both sides have just pulled back from.
Well, they both had an agreement to not pursue this sort of weaponry that now both sides are eagerly going to develop.
These are medium-range missiles. And this is an agreement that dates back to Reagan, to the 80s. I believe it was Reagan and Gorbachev who originally signed this. Mm-hmm.
And I think this really plays into the Trump White House belief against every kind of multilateral and bilateral agreement. They don't want to be bound by any of them. They don't like the World Trade Organization. They don't really like the United Nations. They don't really, well, they didn't like NAFTA and created an agreement that ended up being pretty similar to it, but with a different name. But in general, they're very resistant to any kind of international check on their activities, really, on anything. And I think that's really the broader context from leaving the INF. But there are, you know, legitimate issues surrounding it. And I've also heard the suggestion that leaving the INF gives the U.S. more of a capability, really, against China, even though China's not a signatory, than it is Russia.
Tracy, was there any chance that withdrawal from this agreement by the United States would lead to compliance by Russia? I'm at a loss to see the strategy here. How does withdrawal from this lead to anything else other than withdrawal and escalation by Russia?
The stated goal was maybe we can get the Russians to come back and negotiate, but I don't think anyone was holding out much hope for that. The United States contends that Russia has been violating this agreement for years, you know, way back into the Obama administration. And so that you would suddenly pull out and expect Russia to come around, I don't think was very realistic. In addition to what Steve you've said, you know, Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, is particularly disdainful of arms control agreements, in addition to anything multilateral, because he feels like it ties the United States' hands in terms of what they can develop.
I think you hit on a key point when we were talking about foreign policy in the Trump administration. He came into this administration having virtually no policy opinions of his own. And so those are all driven by someone, and it's a matter of identifying who that person might be. And I think in this case, you've hit on it in John Bolton. This is this has his fingerprints clearly on it. My question, with my limited Latin, I always like to ask, qui bono? You know, who benefits from this? Steve, from all of this, the withdrawal by both sides, who benefits? Who stands to gain? Because you have a very nervous Europe at this point, looking at two superpowers essentially rearming themselves.
I think, well, first, who benefits are defense contractors here in Washington, who are well represented in the White House. But more pertinently, on a geographic or geopolitical thing, I think actually this should be seen less about a U.S.-Russia conflict. I do think Russia's neighbors should feel quite nervous about what's happening. So in some ways, withdrawal of this treaty is, again, I think it's about the U.S. facing China. And it gives Russia scope really to intimidate some of its neighbors as well. In terms of who benefit and who loses, you look at all of Russia's conflicts, both in the Middle East and with some of the former Soviet republics, as well as, you know, into Western Europe, where, you know, they're playing an increasing role in politics there. Italy has sort of turned to Russia's side now. And then obviously in Eastern Europe, where their proclivity for action is well documented. So that I think that's in terms of the winners and losers. It's really Europe and the Middle East are the losers here. And for the U.S., this is, again, I think they're looking east.
And especially in the context of the United States or the Trump administration being less than enthusiastic about NATO and its participation and its willingness to protect other countries, which is one of the founding principles of NATO, I think the Europeans are especially worried about all of this.
And my great desire is, again, to go back to Helsinki and to be inside that room that where we had the president and Vladimir Putin together alone. And know what was agreed on that we don't know about. What happened, you know, in that room? And is it possible that this is something that was discussed unilaterally between these two, or bilaterally between just these two individuals, and has led to this point? I'm just fascinated by the fact that as much as we know, there's certainly much more that we don't know about what preceded this, and the fact that, like many Trump foreign policy initiatives, none of the partners, the important partners in this, either internally or externally, were notified before it happened. Last word on this one, Steve. Do you think that there is any plan, or have you heard of any plan that's being developed to actually bring forward another type of treaty agreement, or is it just, to use a metaphor, West now?
Yeah, I think Wild West is, well, hopefully not what happens, but I do think that, again, this is pulling back and being unconstrained. The reason, actually, I don't think maybe the Helsinki meeting was necessarily about this. Again, we mentioned John Bolton, who was not a party to that meeting. And it does, you know, the president has this kind of wild group of Republicans with sort of different views. And right now, Bolton's, I would say, on the defense side is in the ascendance. And so that may be the more direct link to what happened, rather than Putin himself whispering in Trump's ear. Not to say that he didn't. I'm not sure that this is the issue that he did it on.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Let's move on finally to our UN report on North Korea. The UN report stated that North Korea was taking definitive steps to ensure that its nuclear weapons could not be destroyed by quote-unquote military strikes, unspecified. A seeming contradiction, actually, to the air quotes tremendous progress that President Trump stated that had been made with North Korea in advance of the scheduled talks at the end of February, I believe.
Yes.
Tracy, I'll go to you, the specifics here.
Yes, well, the context, as you mentioned, is the summit that is coming up between Trump and Kim Jong-un on the 27th of February in Vietnam, which was announced in the State of the Union, which Trump announced in the State of the Union address. So that's the context. And yes, this UN report is saying two things, basically, that one, the North Koreans are moving their weaponry and their infrastructure around to protect it from any kind of airstrike. And two, they continue to violate the sanctions and get around the sanctions in various ways, ship-to-ship fuel transfers and all sorts of illicit measures like that, that rendered, according to the UN, the sanctions ineffective, useless. And so it is a slap in the face to any kind of tremendous progress that Trump has claimed. In addition, the U.S. intelligence community at the same time has come out and said that they are convinced, the agencies are convinced, that Kim will never give up his nuclear weapons, that he sees the survival of his government as dependent on having nuclear weapons. So all of this points in the opposite direction, and there is a lot of criticism of the president for going ahead with another summit, having gotten nothing really from North Korea. The other side of that argument is that, well, it's better still to talk and perhaps move in some direction. So that's where that stands. We'll have to see.
The UN report, Steve, as Tracy mentioned, the U.S. intelligence community had given information in reporting that the North Korean regime was not dismantling weapons and agreeing and keeping agreements that they had made earlier. Is there any chance that the Trump administration gives any more credence to a UN report than it does its own intelligence agency?
None whatsoever. Is the answer to that. And it was interesting in one of these, it's called a pool spray, but basically Trump invites reporters into some event that he's holding. And he was asked about this, like, look, I mean, how do you kind of square what the intelligence agencies are telling you from what you're saying? And he made the claim that they told him, oh, he was somehow misquoted. They were misquoted, and it was fake news. I mean, it was aired on television
live.
so it was an unbelievable claim. But I think, look, Trump is not about to do an about-face on North Korea. That's really the interesting tell here, that I think as long as Kim doesn't do any missile launches, that's Trump's red line. I think he can pretty much do what he wants. I think Kim has figured that out. And I think Trump, for his part, that's what he cares about. He doesn't seem to care about any other issue. It's a containment issue. I think it's a dangerous strategy, but nonetheless, that is his strategy, and he's going forward with it no matter what.
And, Tracy, I'll go to you. As the talks, talks are about to begin, if the administration doesn't believe the UN report, doesn't believe the U.S. intelligence community, what, in fact, is the baseline of fact that you're using to go into a set of talks? Where do we start?
Well, I think the administration probably does believe a lot of that. It's President Trump himself who is resistant to any kind of detail, frankly. You know, he likes the optics. I think Steve is exactly right that as long as Kim isn't launching missiles, that's okay for Trump. And, you know, in the last summit last year in Singapore, after the meeting, Trump abruptly ended joint South Korea-U.S. military exercises. So it's a little concerning what he does see as the base. You know, does he decide to declare an end to the Korean War, which is what North Korea would like, but then would be less justification for the U.S. to have troops in the region. So it's very unknown, very complicated what he really sees in this beyond the optics and his sort of legacy of having been the first U.S. president to sit down with the North Koreans.
And if beyond these talks, the North Koreans stay nuclear, they continue with their program, what could be a next step? Where do you go from there?
Good question. You hope for containment, as Steve mentioned. I think that's the most that future governments will be looking for. I think that there has to be eventually a consensus that you're not going to denuclearize.
It's a tough one.
and spelling it too. North Korea. You're going to have to just contain it, bring it within some sort of protocol of you know, no first strikes, that sort of thing. And I think that's the best that you can hope for.
And fortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. I want to thank Steve Goldstein of MarketWatch and Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times. This program is produced by Patrice Martin. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.